Good afternoon, everyone. It's been mentioned a couple of times already, but hope everyone's enjoying the wonderful weather. For most people, snow is a little bit like visitors. Yeah, you're excited when it comes and excited when it leaves. That was the way it was at our house. We were happy to see it come, and then, you know, as those last filthy dregs start to go out of the parking lots and everything, it's nice to see the actual ground again. Last week, for those of you who were here last week, Mr. Swaggerty spoke about the importance of keeping material possessions in their proper place in your life, especially in our culture, relative to not overly depending on material things. And that's a really perfect lead-in for today's message. We'll review just a tiny bit of that, and then go into a lot more specifics on a subject that he just referenced. So I'd like to start today with a quote from the American essayist Logan Pearsall Smith, who said that those who set out to serve both God and mammon soon discover that there is no God. And this reference is, of course, to the New Testament accounts, both in Matthew 6 and Luke 9, where Jesus said that it's impossible for a person to serve both God and mammon. Now, the observation that Mr. Smith made is that the vast majority of those who try to do both soon forsake the more challenging of the two and wind up pursuing the one which comes more naturally to us, which is the mammon. Let's go back to Matthew 6 and read Jesus' full statement, Matthew chapter 6. In verse 24, Matthew 6, 24, here again, this is Jesus speaking, and he says, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." Now, there's several interesting points to magnify the meaning of what Jesus said here. First is that the word mammon in its broad sense refers to material possessions rather than to only money. This concept of this word takes in all of the physical things that you might want to own or control. Another point to consider is that the word serve in this verse means in its literal sense to be a slave. To be a slave. Jesus was not speaking of merely pursuing material possessions in the normal course of meeting life's needs. He was addressing a mindset toward them where they literally take the place of God. So the whole of Jesus' statement cuts to the heart both of our priorities and that which receives our trust and reliance. In his comments on this verse, William Barclay writes, "Surely there is no better description of a person's God than to say it is the power in whom he or she trusts. When people put their trust in material things, then material things have become not their support, but their God." So if we wish to observe and internalize what Jesus said, it cannot be so for us. In our lives, it must be the case that we serve God alone rather than any material pursuits. So when we think about how to apply this in practice throughout our day-to-day lives, there is perhaps no better way to demonstrate our own commitment to this principle than to obey the law of tithing. Obedience to this one law gives us the opportunity to regularly choose, during the normal course of our daily lives, to place God above all that we might utilize and accumulate in this physical world. So today, let's take some time to consider the biblical doctrine of tithing and review what it means for us both physically and spiritually. So to thoroughly examine this topic, we'll cover seven distinct elements of the law of tithing, which are the foundation of tithing first, and then the purposes of tithing, both communal and individual. Then we'll look at some of the procedural components of tithing, and then we'll look in detail at each of the three distinct tithes in the Bible. And then finally, we'll look at the heart of tithing. And so before we cover all of those elements, to give some credit for the inspiration and for some of the material here, for some helpful resources that you can reference, you can go to the study papers link on our members' website at members.ucg.org. There's a study paper link under the resources menu. There's no password or anything like that. And there's several papers on tithing topics that are very helpful there. So let's dive in then to the foundation of tithing as the first element, the foundation of tithing. So to set a proper foundation for understanding the law of tithing, the first thing that we should understand is where it is that money and material things come from. Why do material things exist? And this starts to get into that age-old question, why is there something rather than nothing? And you can certainly find a lot of flaky philosophical answers out there that try to sidestep the need, the obvious need for an external force or an external agency to explain the origin of matter and the physical things that we observe in the universe. But we believe, based on logical and observational and revelatory evidence, that the God of the Bible created everything in the universe through Jesus Christ. And when it comes right down to it, every particle of matter that crosses paths with our lives in any way owes its origin to something apart from and outside of ourselves. No person on this earth can claim to have created a single molecule of their own body. And even when we participate in the initiation and development of a new human life through having children, we're not responsible exclusively for bringing a single cell of that child's body into existence either. So since we haven't created a single shred of anything in this world, do we really own anything? And the obvious answer is no. We don't really, truly own anything. Even for the wealthiest person in this world, we are at the very best temporary stewards of a relatively small portion of physical goods. And that's only for a fleeting moment in time. So coming to grips with that reality constructs the foundations of an attitude that we must have toward physical possessions in order to truly embrace the law of tithing. And that's shown both in the Old and New Testament. Let's look at a couple of examples starting in Psalm 24. Psalm chapter 24. And in verse 1, this is a Psalm of David, and it says, "The earth is the Lord's and all its fullness, the world and those who dwell therein." So at least on this planet that we live on, it says that everything here is God's, including all of the people here. Let's go to Deuteronomy 8. Deuteronomy 8 as well. And the background here is that Moses was warning the people not to become proud and not to think that they were responsible for their wealth after God had blessed them. And in verse 18 it says, "And you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he swore to his fathers as it is this day." So any wealth that says that we happen to have, we need to remember that that comes from God as the source. The New Testament says the same. Let's go to Colossians 1. Colossians chapter 1. Colossians chapter 1, starting in verse 15, "He, Jesus Christ, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. By him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. All things were created through him and for him." So that starts to get outside of even this planet that we live on, right? It says that everything in this universe. And then let's go to John chapter 1 as well. Paul's words in Colossians show that it's really hard to overstate the extent to which the whole physical creation owes its existence to God and Christ as the Creator. Another passage that makes this very clear is John 1, starting in verse 1, which says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him, nothing was made that was made." Now, in the translation in William Barclay's New Daily Study Bible, it makes verse 3 even more explicit, rendering it this way: "He," meaning the Word, "was the agent through whom all things were made. And there is not a single thing which exists in this world which came into being without him." The Expositor's Bible Commentary expansion on this same verse concurs with this rendering when it states this: "The visible universe, with all its complexity, owes its origin to the creative mind and power of God. Apart from his word, existence is impossible." So over the decades that the church has understood and taught the law of tithing, it has consistently asserted that understanding God's ultimate ownership of all physical possessions is the foundation of the doctrine of tithing. So now with that foundation in place, let's move on to consider why it is that God has instituted tithing as a law. So we'll look at the purposes of tithing, starting with the communal purposes. So tithing was instituted to serve several communal purposes that benefit the collective body of God's people. And as an overview, I'd like to quote from the Fundamental Beliefs of the United Church of God. The statement on tithing says this. It says, "We believe in tithing as a way of honoring God with our substance and as a means of serving him in preaching the gospel, the care of the church, attending the festivals, and helping the needy." So as a general approach to our faith and practice in our calling to God's way of life, we hold a pretty deeply rooted conviction that God tells us to do things for a reason, right? God's commandments result either in spiritual learning or in serving a practical purpose or in both. And the law of tithing is no different. So you'll notice that one spiritual element and then four practical communal functions are mentioned in the statement of belief. Spiritually, the law of tithing teaches us to honor God with our possessions, as it says. And then functionally, four major needs are met: preaching the gospel, caring for physical congregations, keeping God's feasts, and caring for those in need. So we'll talk more in a few moments about how each of those purposes is served by the three separate tithes that God instituted. But before we get to that, let's briefly consider the individual purpose of tithing as well. Now, to do that, let's consider a reality that's true for all of God's commands. The results of obedience or disobedience are realized primarily in the life of the individual who obeys or disobeys. Now, secondarily, there, of course, is also an impact to the congregation or to society, and those social settings prosper or fail a bit as each individual succeeds or fails. But the primary physical and spiritual impact for choices is to the individual who chooses. So here again, it is the same. Those primary physical and spiritual impacts of tithing are in our individual relationships with God, the Father, and Jesus Christ. Another way of thinking about this is to say that tithing is really a very personal matter of obedience between each one of us and God. The church teaches the doctrine of tithing, but it does not enforce the practice of tithing. No one is keeping track of whether we've paid our tithes, either here locally or at the home office in Cincinnati. No one's going to pay them for us, and no one's going to ask us why we haven't paid them. We determine how much to pay, when to pay, and where to pay it to. So unequivocally, tithing is between the individual and God, which means that its individual purpose is to develop and strengthen our character and our relationship with him. So now, with the foundation and these communal and individual purposes in mind, let's look in detail at some of the procedural components of the tithing law that God has commanded. So as we go through these, we'll reference some of the scriptural basis for each one without turning to any scriptures, and then we'll go through the scriptures in detail for each distinct tithe at a later point. So the first procedural component of tithing is increase resulting from productive effort. Increase resulting from productive effort. So we saw before in our statement on tithing as a fundamental of belief that it spells out the goal of honoring God with our substance. And this comes from Proverbs 3:9, where it says, "Honor the Lord with your possessions." So let's try to bring that principle down to a practical level. Which possessions should we honor God with? In the context of tithing, the specific question would be, what should I tithe on? And thankfully, the Bible provides the answer for us. And there are two stages to understand here. First, all scriptural references to tithing as an action relate it to the possessions that we obtain as a result of productive effort, or work, as we call it. That's the first stage. Now, to refine that baseline one more step, the same scriptures make it clear that the requirements of tithing as an action only apply to the portion of productive effort that increases our wealth to a level that's higher than what it was before the productive effort took place. So in other words, tithing is only required when a profit is realized from some form of work. So these two stages immediately establish a couple of practical guidelines for the practice of tithing. First is that we should only tithe on any given set of increase once. After a set of increase is tithed on, if we can put it that way, we don't tithe on it again at some future time. The second is that we can see that tithing is a regular and recurring practice. We should tithe as often as we realize an increase from some of our labors. The church's main study paper on tithing explains it this way. It says, in the case of all three tithes, the base of computing the amount is the individual's annual increase. The English word increase is from a Hebrew word meaning gain, fruit, product, or income. The church has understood this to refer to the increase in net worth resulting from productive effort during a year. So increase, then, is the gain that is actually yours, that you actually get to keep after subtracting the costs of doing business, as we refer to them sometimes. Now, it should be mentioned here that the wide variety of ways to support oneself in our modern age generate a virtually endless list of questions about specifics of how to define increase in individual situations. And the church has historically chosen for good reason to not try to produce exhaustive lists of how you handle each and every single situation. But rather, the church has made the foundational principles clear and then given some broad guidelines for common questions, and then as a last measure, of course, the ministry could provide further guidance about a complex or irregular situation. But even the church has modified its guidance on specific issues over time. For example, on the question of whether to tithe on gross income versus net income. So the church previously leaned toward tithing on gross when possible, when tax rates were lower. Now that tax rates are higher, the guidance leans more towards viewing taxes as a cost of doing business that you could subtract when calculating increase, even for a regular wage earner. But regardless of the question, the bottom line is that each individual is responsible for honestly calculating their own increase in faith before God. We should know the scriptures, and we should consider the church's guidance, and we should seek some wise counsel if we need it. But ultimately, we are on the hook to rightly decide to the best of our ability for our own circumstances. Not anyone else's circumstances, for our circumstances. So God knows our hearts. He alone is able to properly judge and properly evaluate both our math and, more importantly, the attitude with which we calculate our individual increase from a productive effort. The next procedural component of tithing would be computing the tithe amount, or the computation of tithes. Now here, we would ask the question, how much should I tithe? And thankfully, once again, the Bible answers that for us. Almost all of the questions that might be a little bit tricky or ambiguous about how much to tithe revolve around how to calculate the increase. Once the amount of increase has been determined, then the next step doesn't really have any room for ambiguity. The English word tithe itself comes from the Hebrew word used in Scripture, which means a tenth part, as in 10% of a total amount. So when you've calculated your amount of total increase, you can take your calculator or smartphone or take off your shoes and use your fingers and toes if you have to and calculate 10% of that total increase. As we've already mentioned, the Bible does specify multiple distinct tithes, so you'd use that same tithe amount when you calculate the increase for each one of those tithes. The next component then would be the frequency of tithing. And so here we would ask the question, how often should I tithe? Well, as we discussed previously, the designation of increase from productive effort as the computational base for calculating your tithe amount kind of answers that question for us, but it's worth a little bit of separate focus anyway. The simple answer is that we should be tithing regularly based on a schedule that makes sense for how we receive our income from productive effort. But in general, one rule of thumb would be to calculate and set aside your tithes relatively soon after you receive that increase. And again, no one's watching. No one's going to be sitting around with a stopwatch wondering how long it's going to take you to set aside your tithes. But we all know from experience that bad things start to happen when you procrastinate on an important obligation. So if your tithe money is just sitting around for a long period of time before you set it aside, Murphy's Law can come to your house and it's tempting to use that money for something else. Maybe even a greater danger is that the longer that money sits there before you set it aside, the greater the temptation to start thinking that maybe it should be your money instead of God's money. So in general, it's better to avoid those temptations and set your tithes aside sooner than later. The final procedural component then would be the destination of the tithes. Now, here we would ask the question, what do I do? What do I do with these tithes after I've set them aside? And since there are three different tithes with different purposes, we'll consider each of them individually, starting with the tithe for the support of God's work, or first tithe, as we usually refer to it. Now, this tithe supports the functions of preaching the gospel and caring for the congregation that are referenced in our statement of belief. And in ancient Israel, this would have meant the support of the priests and the Levites and care of the temple and those types of things. In our day, it means support for the work of the church. We staff an organization with ministerial and administrative resources. We care for the local congregations. And, of course, there's expenses related with preaching the gospel. So if we consider those functions and step back for a moment, it becomes obvious fairly quickly that the first tithe is not retained by the individual. Rather, it would be given to a faithful representative of God's work who would coordinate those intended functions. So in ancient Israel, that meant that tithes were physically taken to the temple and handed over to the representatives of God's work there. In our time, tithes are collected either locally or centrally by the physical church organization and then faithfully managed by those who have the responsibility to do so. Now, this is a good point to mention that we do have a responsibility to do more than simply pay and pray, as the old saying goes. But as with many things, there's a balanced approach that we have to maintain. So on the one hand, God does expect us to ensure that our tithes are going to a place where God's word is faithfully adhered to in doctrine and in practice, and we can see the work of God being carried out as outlined in the scriptures. But once we're sure of that, in a sense, we have to send in our tithes in faith that the people with the responsibility to manage them are going to do so to the best of their ability before God. So we're not tasked as individuals with micromanaging the church's expenses, and we should certainly never try to withhold our tithes as a means of trying to influence church policy or priority or anything like that. That approach is wrong-spirited and unscriptural, but it's also just really ineffective. So next, we would consider the destination of our second tithe, or the festival tithe. So the tithe that we usually refer to as second tithe supports the expenses of keeping God's annual feasts, as referenced in our statement of belief. And here, as we will see when we go through the scriptures, it's clear that this tithe is to be managed by the individual, in contrast to first tithe. So in practice, each person is responsible for managing their own expenses and observing the feasts each year with the second tithe that they set aside. One other point to consider, though, is that the scriptures are clear that we need to consider the others, consider the needs of others in relation to festival observance, especially those who are less fortunate than us. So we should be careful to try to make sure that this tithe is used both for our benefit and for the benefit of others to the extent that we have the ability and opportunity. And then finally, for this component, we would consider the destination of the tithe to support the poor, or third tithe, as we usually call it. So this tithe supports the ever-present obligation to care for those who are in need, again, as referenced in our statement of belief. And this would refer more to the day-to-day needs than specifically to observing the festivals or something like that. So in ancient Israel, the third tithe was stored up within the gates or within the property of the individual and then distributed directly to those who could benefit from it. And the church has historically taught that individuals are free to distribute their own third tithe to those within their lives, perhaps a widow or an orphan or someone else in need who's within the family or close to the family as they have opportunity. But of course, in the case of either excess second tithe or third tithe, if we don't have someone within our own lives that we could provide assistance to personally, then the church will, of course, collect that and help those who are in need that we might not know about. So that covers the procedural components of tithing. So with that background, on top of the foundation and the purposes of tithing, let's examine the scriptures relevant to each distinct and separate tithe so that we can get a comprehensive view of each one. So first we'll look again at the tithe for the support of God's work, or first tithe as we usually refer to it. Now for this tithe, the first biblical record comes after Abraham had rescued his nephew Lot and some of the people and goods that had been taken away from the king of Sodom. Now, this story is in Genesis 14, where after Abraham's victory, he encounters the priest king Melchizedek. So let's go to Genesis 14, Genesis chapter 14. Starting in verse 18, which says, "Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. And he, Melchizedek, blessed him, Abraham, and said, 'Blessed be Abraham of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand.' And he, Abraham, gave him, Melchizedek, a tithe of all." So the church's main study paper on tithing points out that this one account does this. It says, quote, "It establishes the key points of tithing. First, the recipient of the tithe, God's representative on the earth at the time, who was the source of God's blessings to the tithe payer. In this case, that representative was Melchizedek. Second, the reason for tithing, acknowledgement of God as the ultimate owner of all wealth and provider of all blessings. And then third, the computational base for tithing, all of Abraham's increase, in this case, the spoils of the battle," end quote. So we can see that tithing was a revealed practice that even the earliest of the patriarchs obeyed. Later in Genesis, in chapter 28, Abraham's grandson Jacob, who later became Israel, followed in the footsteps of his grandfather Abraham and vowed to give a tenth of all that God gave him back to God as a tithe. When Israel became a nation, and the priesthood that was established through Levi, God reiterated the designation of this tithe as both belonging to him and holy to him. Let's look at that in Leviticus 27, Leviticus chapter 27. In verse 30, where it says, "And all the tithe of the land, whether the seed of the land or of the fruit of the tree, is the Lord's. It is holy to the Lord." Now the word holy in the last part of this verse comes from the Hebrew word kodesh, which can also mean a consecrated thing or a dedicated thing. So in other words, this tithe has been set apart by God for a designated or a specific purpose. God also made it clear that this tithe was to be received by the Levites rather than retained by the individual. Let's look at that in Numbers 18, Numbers chapter 18. In verse 21, Numbers 18:21, where it says, "Behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tithes in Israel as an inheritance, in return for the work which they perform, the work of the tabernacle of meeting." Verse 24, "For the tithes of the children of Israel, which they offer up as a heave offering to the Lord, I have given to the Levites as an inheritance." Now, the tribe of Levi was the only tribe not given a land inheritance when Israel crossed into the promised land. They had no land with which to sustain themselves and the requirements of the full-time religious service to God and to the people. So here we begin to see clearly that the purpose of this first tithe was to support and sustain the physical work that God was doing on earth. Now, with Israel, unfortunately, as with many other aspects of obedience to God's laws, they were faithful only for brief stages in their history. During two separate periods of renewal, one in the time of Hezekiah and another in the time of Nehemiah, tithing was one of the cornerstones of some reforms that were implemented that made the temple and the religious practice operational again. You can find more information about those in 2 Chronicles 31 and Nehemiah 13. Finally, then, in the Old Testament, the prophet Malachi was inspired to remind the nation of Israel of the tithing obligations that they had forgotten. So we believe, of course, that Malachi's message was not intended just for the physical nation of Israel, but that it extends to spiritual Israel as a message about obedience to God. So let's look at that in Malachi chapter 8. Malachi 8. The very end of the Old Testament. I'm sorry, Malachi chapter 3. Malachi chapter 3, verse 8, where it says, "Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. You say, in what way have we robbed you? In tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house, and try me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such a blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it." So it's very much worth noting in these verses that God equates the failure to tithe with robbing him, or to look at it another way, with breaking the eighth commandment and stealing what he says is his. God says that this tithe belongs to him. So since he lays such explicit claim to it, we dare not ignore it. But as this verse also shows, we shouldn't need to be motivated by fear. Tithing is a blessing, it says. And God says through Malachi that it also brings about a blessing when we make God a priority in our lives through faithful obedience to this law. Now, that doesn't say that we're guaranteed riches or great wealth if we tithe. That's not correct either, any more than giving based only on fear is correct. Malachi's words were really meant to address not simply a lack of physical giving, but a lack of the respect and reverence and love for God that should motivate that giving. So what God does promise through Malachi is that when we faithfully adhere to this commandment with the right attitude and faithfully give because of our love for God, then we will receive the physical and spiritual blessings. But we know, of course, that the biblical instruction on tithing is not confined to the Old Testament either. Perhaps most importantly, Jesus Christ himself upheld the importance of tithing in Matthew chapter 23. Let's go to Matthew 23. Matthew chapter 23 and verse 23, where Jesus said, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone." So the central point of this verse is, of course, that a Christian must not let their priorities get out of whack with respect to physical obedience of a law. As the Nelson Study Bible puts its comments on this verse, Jesus was not saying that tithing was unimportant. He was pointing out that the scribes and Pharisees were emphasizing one area, which was physical, over another area, which was spiritual. However, for the purposes of our discussion today on tithing, it's important to note that Jesus did uphold the importance of tithing, that it should not be neglected. It's also significant to note that he didn't criticize some meticulous thoroughness with tithing. William Barclay points out that mint and dill and cumin are herbs of the kitchen garden, he says, and that they would not have been grown in any substantial quantity. Sometimes families might have only had one plant. So to tithe that would be to tithe a very small quantity. So again, while we remember that we emphasize the spiritual more than the physical details are not unimportant according to Jesus' statement. Now there are also two other passages that when you put them together form a strong New Testament support for a continuation of this first tithe beyond the Old Testament. In the middle of the book of Hebrews, the author spends the length of several chapters establishing that in Christianity, the priesthood that was descended from Levi has been replaced. So Hebrews 6:20 specifically says that Jesus Christ has become high priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek, it says. Now recall from Genesis 14 that Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek as the first biblical record of tithing. The author of Hebrews goes on to argue in chapter 7 that in one sense, even Levi himself paid tithes to Melchizedek through Abraham, who he was descended from. So the Expositor's Bible commentary points out in its comments on some of the verses in chapter 7 that the Levitical priesthood, quote, owed their ability to collect tithes to the provision made in the law and not to any natural superiority. But with Melchizedek, it was different. He did not trace his descent from Levi. And to take that one step further, our booklet titled Who is God explains, based on biblical evidence, that Melchizedek himself, quote, could have only been the eternal pre-existent Word who later became Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So the main thrust of the line of reasoning in Hebrews is to establish that the authority and responsibility of the priesthood descended from Levi had been transferred to Jesus Christ as high priest under the new covenant. And as the full explanation in Hebrews shows, it's a far better priesthood that now stands in place of the old one, with the same being who received tithes from Abraham as the high priest under this administration. Our booklet titled, What Does the Bible Teach About Tithing, explains it this way. It says, the priesthood of Jesus Christ is vastly superior to the priesthood of Levi in every way. It necessitated a change of the law relating to the priesthood because the law God gave by Moses included no instruction regarding a high priest from Judah. This change of the law had to do with a change in the administration, not with the wholesale annulling of the law, as mainstream Christianity believes. It meant that the administration of tithing would change with this change in priesthood from that of Levi to that of Melchizedek or Christ. So to this understanding, we would also add from many other scriptures that God has, of course, ordained a dedicated ministry to serve under Jesus Christ in place of the priesthood descended from Levi. And even if we look at other scriptures about the temple, for example, the temple itself is replaced by the church, which is now the spiritual temple of God. There's a passage in 1 Corinthians where Paul vigorously argues that the ministry should be able to make a living from the labor that they provide in service to the church and in service to God. And again, the church is the spiritual temple and center of God's work on earth. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. And here Paul concludes his argument starting in verse 13 where he says, do you not know that those who minister the holy thing eat of the things of the temple, which would have included the tithes of the people of Israel? And those who serve at the altar partake of the offerings of the altar. Verse 14, even so the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should live from the gospel. So in mainstream Christianity today, most churches who teach that tithing is not required or obligatory replace it with a concept of free will giving or grace giving, as it's sometimes referred to. But almost invariably, that doctrine of grace giving that replaces tithing is tied to the incorrect teaching that the entirety of the law has been removed and replaced by grace. So in contrast, we believe that this first tithe is a concrete demonstration of our honor and reverence for God, and that was in place before the Sinaitic covenant or Mosaic law. God claims this tithe for himself, he designates it as holy, and he uses it to support his work on earth. And it hasn't been discontinued anywhere in the New Testament, nor is there any evidence anywhere in the Bible of God relinquishing his claim to this tithe. So his work, including the paid ministry and the expenses of the gospel and local congregations, we believe that that continues in the New Testament church and is financed by this first tithe. So let's look next then at the festival tithe, or second tithe, in Scripture. So the explicit biblical instruction on the tithe that we refer to as second tithe is found in the book of Deuteronomy. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 12, Deuteronomy 12, where it's first mentioned. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 17, where it says, "You may not eat within your gates the tithe of your grain or your new wine or your oil, of the first block of your herd or of your flock, of any of your offerings which you vow, of your freewill offerings, or of the heave offering of your hand. But you must eat them before the Lord your God in the place which the Lord your God chooses, you and your son and your daughter, your male and your male servant and your female servant, the Levite who is within your gates, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God in all to which you put your hands." Now the first point to note here is that this tithe was to be consumed by the individual who sets it aside. Now as we previously saw in Numbers 18, verse 21, God commanded the entirety of the first tithe to be given to the Levites during that time period. And as we also saw, under the new covenant, that tithe was transferred to supporting the work under a new form or administration in the church. So the only logical conclusion that we can come to here is that this tithe described in Deuteronomy is a separate and distinct tithe from the one that should be given to the representatives of God's work. The second point that we'll discuss more later is to note that it should be consumed with rejoicing, that that's specified. Let's go just a few pages over to Deuteronomy 14, where there's more instruction about this tithe. Deuteronomy 14, starting in verse 22, where it says, "You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. And you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe of your grain and your new wine and your oil, of the firstborn of your herds and your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always." In verses 24 and 25, if you can't carry the tithe, you can convert it into money. And then in verse 26, it says, "And you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep, for wine or similar drink, for whatever your heart desires. You shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household." So here again, a key point is that the individual was to rejoice in consuming the tithe that was specified along with their households. Now note also that these verses clearly indicate both travel to the place where God puts his name and enjoyment in abundance rather than just merely subsistence consumption. So finally then, again, as in Deuteronomy 12, it's laid down that this tithe is not to be consumed with a heavy face or with a sad heart. It's to be consumed with rejoicing, as it says. So when and where, the question comes, is this rejoicing? Where does this rejoicing take place? Well, in just a few more pages, it becomes obvious that it's during the annual festivals that are established by God. Deuteronomy 16 reviews the instruction to keep the annual festival. And throughout that chapter, there are admonitions to enjoy the abundance of God's blessings and to rejoice, using the same language that's in Deuteronomy 14. So those commands, the two commands in Deuteronomy 12 and 14, are obviously about that tithe and consumption that was to take place at the annual festivals where God would put his name. It's also clear in Deuteronomy 16 that that rejoicing was to be financed from the increase of a year's productive effort. Let's go to Deuteronomy 16, verse 15. Deuteronomy 16, 15. And this is in reference to the Feast of Tabernacles, where it says, 7 days you shall keep a sacred feast to the Lord your God in the place which the Lord chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you surely rejoice. Now at the end of verse 15, that word translated produce in the New King James is the same word as increase in Deuteronomy 14:22, where the command is given to set aside a tithe of that increase. And in fact, the original King James translates that produce as increase in Deuteronomy 16:15. So it's quite clear that the festival observance was intended to be planned for and financed in a regular and reliable way from the same increase due to productive effort that was tied on separately to support God's work. Now here again, in mainstream Christianity, the validity of a festival or a second tithe isn't really realized because the validity of the festivals themselves is not recognized. But, of course, we certainly believe, based on both the Old Testament and New Testament, that God instituted these festivals to be observed in perpetuity. So it only makes sense that God, as a very careful and loving planner, would institute a permanent practice for financing that festival observance. Next, then, we'll look at the tithe for the support of the poor, or third tithe, as we usually refer to it. Now, the explicit biblical instructions for this tithe are also found in the book of Deuteronomy. The first mention is right after the instruction for the festival tithe in Deuteronomy 14. So let's read Deuteronomy 14, starting in verse 28, where it says, "At the end of every third year, you shall bring out the tithe of your produce of that year and store it up within your gates. And the Levite, because he has no portion nor inheritance with you, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow who are within your gates, may come and eat and be satisfied, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do." Now, several things are significant to note here. One is a preference to this, or preface to this verse, is to recall that the first tithe to support God's work and the second tithe for festival observance, those are already spoken for in their entirety. And this point is emphasized by the statement here that this tithe was to be stored up within the gates, rather than given to a representative of God's work or consumed by the individual as with the other two tithes. So here we have a third and distinctly separate tithe. Now it's also noteworthy that the source of this tithe is specified yet again as the increase of productive effort. Just as with Deuteronomy 16:15, the word produce here in verse 28 of Deuteronomy 24 is again that same word that is translated as increase in the original King James. The recipients of this tithe are clearly specified in this verse as the Levite and the fatherless and the widow and a stranger or a foreigner. Now, generally, these were the members of society at the time who would not have had land or a means of supporting and sustaining themselves. So in our day, we would translate this simply to anyone who has a legitimate need and is unable to support themselves, either for a short term or a longer term. Now, uniquely for this tithe, a frequency of every third year is specified. And that's, of course, different from the other two tithes, which were to be set aside annually. Now, as the main study paper on tithing explains very well, the application of this requirement would really have been within the third and sixth years of a seven-year cycle, so that the land Sabbath laws could also be respected. If you didn't do it within a seven-year cycle, then you would have had a problem after 7 years of three-year cycles where the third tithe and land Sabbath laws would conflict. So the third tithe, as the church understands it, would have been mandated for the third and sixth years of a seven-year cycle. Now, one last dimension that isn't mentioned here, but in Deuteronomy 26, is that this tithe was also considered holy to God. Now, as Jesus Christ clearly stated in John 12:8, he said, "The poor you have with you always," and there's ample evidence to support that in any age of history or society. Many other scriptures clearly state that Christians are indeed obligated to do what they can to support those who are less fortunate, especially within the church, with the abundance of God's blessings that they receive. However, this tithe does have a unique consideration that the others don't. Even within Israel, it served both a spiritual and a civil function. So there's, of course, tremendous spiritual benefit, both for the giver and for the receiver, in giving to those who are less fortunate. But in addition, as an independent nation or kingdom at the time, Israel had a very real social or municipal need that this tithe met. And unlike either the tithe that supports God's work or the festival tithe, most modern governments have instituted some level of taxation that supports social welfare programs that duplicate the civil needs that third tithe was intended for. So that brings up the question of whether we as Christians are obligated to double pay in some cases. So the Council of Elders of the United Church of God has addressed this as an administrative issue, and there is a specific study paper on third tithe that provides some of the background for their decision, even going all the way back to some of the administrative decisions made by Herbert Armstrong in the Worldwide Church of God. I'll just read the summary statement that's included both in the main study paper on tithing and in our booklet, What Does the Bible Teach About Tithing? It says this: "The Council of Elders has resolved that where governments provide programs, the intent and purpose of which is to provide for the needs of those that the biblical third tithe was designed to assist, and that where such programs are funded by an annual rate of taxation greater than the biblical third tithe, members are not obligated to pay what amounts to an additional third tithe to the church. The Council of Elders further resolves that since there will always be members of the church whose needs will not be adequately provided for by national government social programs, and since the clear example in Scripture is that the church care for its members in need, that those members of the church who are able are encouraged to contribute to the church assistance fund so that the biblical injunction to care for the needy within the church can be fulfilled." So that's the statement itself, and there are 2 points to note from the statement just before closing on this topic of third tithe. One would be that the administrative ruling of the church is by nature conditional. In other words, it provides a ruling for a given scenario rather than a complete annulment of the third tithe itself. And the second point, similarly, is that while the church's administrative ruling does provide relief in applicable scenarios from burdensome taxation, it does not change or annul the Christian obligation to do what we can for those who are less fortunate than us. So when we consider both of those points together with the ruling, it's clear that there's really not a one-size-fits-all decree for the application of third tithe in our day or in modern societies. So kind of back to the point that we discussed at the start of the sermon, we each have an individual responsibility to consider the scriptures, to consider the church's guidance, and then to make an honest judgment before God about the appropriate course of action in our own circumstances. So one final point to make then before moving on is that in the discussion of these three distinct tithes, there is significant extra-biblical support for the tithes being separate and distinct from each other. So if you go to the church's main study paper on tithing, there's a really good explanation of all of those extra-biblical resources as well. So finally then, let's cover the heart of tithing as our last section, the heart of tithing. So before we conclude, we should stop and consider what our attitude toward tithing should be as we strive to obey the physical law and also the spiritual implication of these tithing laws that God has instituted. The cleric John Wesley once quipped, "When I have money, I get rid of it quickly, lest it find a way into my heart. And the problem with money and all physical possessions in general is that they can so easily and so quickly have a place in our hearts that they should never have. So as devoted Christians, we must be honest with ourselves that tithing is a major financial commitment. Whether your income is large or small, when you take 20% of it to support the tithe for God's work and the festival tithe, that's a significant expenditure. And if you happen to be keeping the tithe for the poor as well, then it's that much greater of an impact on your personal budget. So as part of quite literally counting the cost of obedience to this teaching, we should be honest with ourselves that following through on the commitment won't always be easy and won't always come naturally. Obedience to this doctrine does require a sustained commitment and effort. So as we think about how to do that month after month, year after year in our lives, perhaps more than anything else, we can be motivated to continue putting it into practice in our lives with this. At its very core, tithing is an act of worship. Tithing is an act of worship. And understanding that is a major key to practicing it faithfully, even in times when we feel like maybe we'd rather not. Viewing it from this perspective can turn what might seem like a burdensome obligation into a tangible demonstration of love for God and a tangible recognition of the love that God shows for us. So as we consider what it means to tithe with reverence and respect toward God, it's very instructive to consider the first recorded act of worship, which is in Genesis 4, Genesis chapter 4, starting in verse 3, which says, "And in the process of time it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering." Now, while the subject of this account is an offering rather than giving tithes specifically, this is one of the places in Scripture that most clearly shows that the most important aspect of any giving is the attitude with which we give. Even specific to tithing, for example, we can recall the self-righteous Pharisee in Jesus' parable in Luke 18, where he prayed, "I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all I possess." But as Jesus went on to show, his actions were really useless and ineffective because of his attitude, because of what was in his heart. In its comments on Cain and Abel's offerings, the Expositor's Bible Commentary points out that the account does not elaborate on any of the physical differences between the two offerings, and that indeed the physical differences don't really matter. The heart of what is recorded, it says, is that worship that pleases God springs from a pure heart. Worship that pleases God springs from a pure heart. And from what we can see in the full account in Genesis, Abel had that purity of heart, and Cain did not. The writer of Hebrews seems to agree in chapter 11 of that book when he commends Abel for giving an offering as an example of faith. And the Expositor's commentary on those verses says that because Abel had a right relationship with God, his offering was a demonstration of his faith, just as our tithing can be with the right attitude. So this example of the right attitude in giving comes to us within the first few pages of the Bible, within the first few chapters even. And we could easily show from many other scriptures that it is our attitude which will be most important in our obedience to the law of tithing. We should remember that it is a great privilege to support the work of God. It is a privilege to keep God's feast. And it is a privilege to give to those who are in need. So our hearts should reflect our thankfulness to be a part of those things as we put God's instructions on tithing into practice in our own lives, both physically and spiritually. So in conclusion, then, brethren, we've seen today that God's law of tithing is very relevant for us as Christians. Far from being an outdated and obsolete practice of Old Testament times, tithing continues as a blessing of God's way of life here and now. So let's be thankful and utilize these laws to put that instruction of Proverbs 3:9, which says, honor the Lord with your possessions, into practice both as an act of worship and of living faith in our own lives.